Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future.
The spice expands.
In here, the results are always positive.
The spice is vital to space travel.
We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, and relax. We are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Boy, have we got a treat for you tonight. The solar wind is 382.4 kilometers per second. There are magnetic fields in the solar wind intensified, indicating the possible passage of a minor coronal mass ejection past Earth. Now, the encounter did not immediately trigger geomagnetic storms, and the NOAA forecasters remain optimistic. However, placing the odds of a polar geomagnetic storm today at 65%. 1 hour from now, we have brand new talk radio personality Don Margolis coming on the program for a couple of hours. We're going to talk about stem cells from all angles. His program is every Friday evening at 5 p.m. Channel 2 at dbsradio.com. But tonight, he's on X Squared Radio. And tonight, everything he says goes into the formula X Squared. So you better have that seatbelt handy and something cold to drink, because it's going to be hot. Our call-in lines, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, could reach us at 530-413-9537. Don't forget that we have our conference line live all night. If you must step away from the computer, you can listen by cell phone. Dial 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. Then put in the access code 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. Put it in your speed dial, because then you can listen anytime to Channel 2. Just hit that speed dial number. Lots in the news. We got about 58 minutes of news, and then we're going to have Don Margolis come on in. It is going to be amazing, let me tell you. Interesting stuff in the news already. We've had a verdict in the George Zimmerman case. Justice is an amazing thing in the United States. We have a system that allows people to be judged by their peers instead of a lawyer or a judge. Once all the evidence is placed in front of them, then they make a fair and unbiased opinion, and we hope that it always works out that way. I know that the emotions run high on this, but I promise that you need to consider the consequences of picking up a weapon, any kind of weapon. I know you're tempted to go out and buy all that food and sit on a pile of it and guard it. And I have to tell you that many people are tempted to do that. But remember my words tonight, when you pick up that weapon, just pick it up. When you point it at a person, everything in your life will change. Your soul will change. Sounds like something that you've seen on lots of movies, but remember, those are actors. Every single one of those people will get up will wash off their makeup and they will go home to their families. But when you pick up a real gun, even if you don't pull the trigger, you'll remember that second for the rest of your life. Trust me, it is not something you want to experience. We have violence, we have conflict in our world, in our dimension. That is inevitable. How you deal with it is what separates you from the animals. So remember my words. When you pick up that piece of iron, you slide your finger in that guard and you point that barrel at someone, there is a beating heart on the other side of that barrel. Whether you pull the trigger or not is of no consequence. Your life will change forever. And if you don't believe my words, then you have lunch with George Zimmerman sometime and ask him. I will quote a colleague, Geraldo Rivera, in his pontification. He stumbled into an amazing statement last night. He said, "All tragedies are not crimes." Just think about that and settle down. All right, something you probably did not hear in the news. Every once in a while, we live in a very strange world of surveillance, but surveillance goes both ways, does it not? I mean, when there is a camera on, when there is a microphone on, it records everything and everyone. Well, a hot mic has apparently picked up some very unflattering words from the president on the 4th of July. Hot or open mics frequently catch public figures unknowingly expressing their candid feelings, usually with colorful language. However, Obama's slip while exiting the balcony of the White House after his fifth Independence Day address may well exceed the average hot mic faux pas. The smaller of Obama's two microphones, which was clipped inches below Obama's shirt collar, was supposed to have been turned off immediately after his closing remarks to guests and reporters on the White House lawn, but the microphone remained hot, catching the president muttering, and I quote, "God, this holiday sucks. All this national pride shit gets on my nerves." Close quote. Not my words. Obama's candid comments are sure to further drag down his approval ratings as recent scandals involving the IRS, the Benghazi terrorist attacks, and massive spying on average citizens by the NSA have sunk Obama's approval numbers below that of former President Bush. It took Obama 30 seconds before he completely exited the White House balcony and removed his microphone, during which it picked up more utterances by the commander-in-chief, none of which pundits view will help his ratings at any time soon. I continue the quotation. "You'd think we'd stop celebrating the birth of the worst imperial power in history. But no, we have to do this flag-waving bullshit every year." Close quote. Obama muttered more as he made his way from the podium. And the last quote, "I can't believe I have to miss a good day of golf for this crap." Close quote. Although Obama's presumably inaudible words were not heard nearly as loudly as his official Independence Day speech, a few reporters and attendees close to the speakers beneath the White House balcony heard him distinctly. Obama tacked on a couple more self-pitying quips before removing his clip-on mic. Quote, "Could have been at Oakmont with Jay-Z now, trying out that new Callaway set Alec Baldwin gave me last year. Damn, this day sucks." Close quote. All right, well, interesting how surveillance of our most private thoughts can cut both ways. don't you think? Well, we face something that has not been visited upon the human race since the fall of the Roman Empire. That fall caused 1,000 years of darkness. It's taken 500 years to dig ourselves out of that morass, and here we are, committing the same sins and behaviors that brought the Romans to their fall. The Romans tried to grow their empire with the loot taken from conquered territories. They eventually tried to finance this expansion with debasement of their precious metal currencies. Sound familiar? In this, they failed utterly, despite the most heavy-handed attempts to retain the empire on the backs of their people, slaves, and those of the conquered territories with taxes, impounds, and thievery. A short look at history shows that we are trying the same exact methods. We will get the same exact results. The present days are starting to look like the beginnings of a super volcano. A magma pool has formed. Fumaroles and ventings smell like sulfur. Small and large earthquakes accumulate until it is clear something bad is going on. The land tilts, lakes start boiling, and shortly thereafter the supervolcano explodes. No leader or country that has taken fiat as a false prophet has ever survived. No regime has held power for more than a few decades, much less centuries, when based on fiat. Those empires must fall. The powers that be know it. They fear the end is coming. Thus we have been seduced through 40 years of a brave new world, soma-like existence to the stark, surprising, and painful reality of the advent of 1984. Wake up, dopesters. That banging sound is really knocking at your door. The flashpoint looms close at hand. Everything is lies, except you. We all have a responsibility to know the truth and live it to the best of our ability. Today, the truth is buried in lies. We try to snatch past the surface to see the truth, but the lies wash over our efforts like the tides. Wave after wave from media of all types. Even as the tide recedes, it leaves its print, covering the bit of truth we've scratched out on the sand. Tides or not, we must never, ever stop scratching in the sand. It is very difficult to get a handle on the moment, as Tommy Lee Jones said in No Country for Old Men. It's a movie worth watching at least once, you know, sparse in words, not one added gratuitously. It notes differences of a couple of generations in a few words while exposing the true evil in one man's attempt to protect his family at the cost of his life. He lost everything. While a man's main job in life is protecting the women in his life, fighting evil is not for the lone man. Though one man or woman can catch the world, can change the world, it takes many to fight the evil and bring the important words into reality. Many talk show hosts, many writers, many public speakers, many preachers, as it were. The people who follow that soul voice will complete that change, even if the one man passes from the scene. Today, we see a litany of lies. These lies go to the heart of what is wrong with this country and this world. The lies are seen as needed to hide the truth of what is going on in the world. One great lie is the human cost and human participation, or lack thereof, in what is one of our most essential qualities, a meaningful job that supports a man, a woman, or a couple's family. That's the bedrock of this world. Something productive, something to add value. Everything in the world evolves from that one point. Now, we don't want to conquer the ocean floor, move mountains, or change history. We want to work, and we want to strive and make a difference, if only in our small universe of family and community. When we are told that everything is okay, and the world as we know it is okay, and we sense that it is a lie, things are going to become unsettled, and very quickly. The human spirit will tolerate much if the goal is worth pursuing. That same spirit will not tolerate lies for very long. When fewer people are in the labor force than since 1980, when 25% are unemployed, or maybe worse yet, underemployed, in jobs that offer little hope for a better life, we are in peril. This country's upward momentum is being stifled by these lies. The wrongness of what is going on in this country is being covered by lies, by entertainment, by distractions. This syndrome is worldwide as well. All major countries face this, including China. The people who we've elected to lead us have abandoned us to a statistical Soylent Green. We've become nothing but voting blocks and campaign cash, told to chase one attractive tyrant or another while promising nirvana, hope, change, transformation, and well-being by those who would lie to us to enslave us. What is our slavery? Believing that a thin skein of lies constantly pumped out to keep us somnolent and unwary of some real and present dangers. We face something that has not been visited upon the human race since the fall of the Roman Empire. That fall caused 1,000 years of darkness. We are wasting our heritage and human spirit. 70% of us are on drugs. The other 30% are trying to figure out what's happening, what's going wrong. Only the tiniest percentage are divorced from its effects. And it is, in its simplest form, our fiat currencies. The Romans tried to grow their empire with the loot taken from conquered territories. We know that. We've seen that. The present days are starting to look just like them. About 75 years ago, Lake Toba near Sumatra exploded into a 300-square-mile caldera. Humanity tipped toward extinction. Barely 10,000 people. 10,000. A number that would fill a small AAA baseball park, clung to life in tiny oases. We suffered, and we survived, and we came out a tougher species. But our human nature did not change a great deal, and we may not have changed much, all things considered. We still find and select leaders who grow acquisitive for great power, and once great power is obtained, these leaders never let it go. Perhaps because of the pivotal Toba event, we often find ourselves reflexively bowing to leaders who promise to take care of us, thinking it's the best thing to do. Thus, requiring the least amount of effort, we can get back to our daily lives because our leaders are taking care of all the tough questions. We turn our fate over to those leaders who are failed humans. Today, our sloth, laziness, greed, cowardice, and dumbed-down nature is clear to anyone who's able to look past the lies to see the truth. In this secular world, sometimes the only truth is what you say it is, not what you see. Be careful what truths you say, because you will end up living those truths if you chose to not believe the lies. Real truth is much more elusive. You must seek that instead of thinking you have the answers after a cursory examination of the untruths. That can become self-deceit in and of itself and can lead you to fatal errors. We have a world filled with leaders who are little more than power-hungry autocrats, with no more forward thinking than to acquire more power or hold what they have. It is far worse than I have ever seen, given the little that I've observed in my short lifetime. We're concerned and we're condemned to repeat the errors of the past when it comes to our poorly formed choices, whether those choices elect our elected leaders or simply involve how we live our lives. It's these leaders' nature to pursue power. Regretfully, it's our nature to bow to power. When given the right to vote, we squander it on one useful idiot or another. If a person chooses not to bow, they can be bought. Everyone has their price. And that's an unpleasant truth. Our survival is in the balance, because that ability to buy us is contained in the empire of fiat and debt. If you don't believe me, take 5 seconds and imagine, just imagine, what would happen if the food stamp cards were cut off for 2 weeks. Just 2 weeks. Cut off the food stamp cards for 2 weeks and blame someone. Blame a party. And watch what happens. You don't think that slavery is complete? This 50-year-old experiment in fiat, unbacked by anything of value, is what is destroying us now. And it is coming to an end. We may have 2 to 3 years at the outside. Most of us don't see this. And even when we do, the addiction is still very powerful. And going cold turkey is nearly impossible. We live within a fiat paradigm from which escape is nearly impossible. So many people have committed themselves to fiat and debt that is, and that tipping point is long past any voluntary change. The flash point looms close at hand. Sustaining the empire of fiat and debt will take everything the powers have at their disposal. That means we will be forced to pay for this effort. And believe me, it all rotates down to the little guy. Every empire has fallen, taking the people down through that painful, deadly transition. And this will be no different. But it will only get bigger if we wait. The matrix is that large. The paradigm that is deeply embedded in our psyche. As the common phrase describes it, the failure will be epic. The powers that be are beginning to think they are smarter than the gods. You remember that, don't you? You've read about that in the scriptures and in history. The powers that be, whether it's the giants or the Anunnaki or the Illuminati, they think they're smarter than God. They think, oh, when the bottom falls out, not to worry. I've got my $40 million mansion in Hawaii. I've got my eagle's nest in the mountains of the Alps. I've got my bunker in the desert of Arizona, stocked with food and guns and water, and I'm off the grid. We think we're smarter, more equipped to manage than the sheeple. Technology, fiat, coercion, surveillance, and hubristic actions are being used to crush the human spirit. It's that one sad part of the human nature that emboldens a small group of people to seek to subjugate larger groups of people. It's the other, the far more important part of the human nature, our human spirit, that always prevails. It always prevails. But to find and reconnect with our spirit, we must go through hard times. That's just the crucible that forges us. It's the refiner's fire. It's why the greatest spirits in the universe come here to this planet to go through this mortal struggle. The anvil of privation and loss, that hammers out the best in us and will bring back to life what we once held dear. That's what makes us willing to sacrifice for the well-being of our fellow human beings. It makes us reach beyond our grasp. It makes us better people. It makes us a better human. And it is my belief that what we do here on this planet and in our lives that will make the difference. Just one person can make a real difference. In fact, all changes that have happened in humanity have started with just one or two people. 1,000 voices make for a huge chorus. But Winston Churchill left an indelible imprint on our thinking. 3 times he saw and survived the horrors of war. His study of history and massive library of observations made him sure of his course. When asked why he didn't despair of the war times and England's perils when they were being bombed nightly, indiscriminately, not military targets, no, city streets. Night after night, the terror continued. Airplanes and rockets and cruise missiles. He observed that in the long course that charted the upward momentum of human endeavors, this war was a momentary downward blip on that chart. And he was not just being optimistic. He was not just a student of history. He was in a position to make history. And he changed the world. And you can do that too. Every single day, you can change history. You can look at the same struggle and you can make a difference. All right, enough pep talk. Hollow Earth. Most of you know by now we've had to delay the expedition to the inner earth. Hold on one moment while I take a wonderful sip of my ice cold orange juice. Wow, I can't just take a sip of that. You just have to gulp a whole bunch of it. It's really good. I had an interview on the Kevin Smith Show this week. And last week, 3 other talk radio programs around the world. Monday, I have one in France. We'll be talking, there's a French translator that will be translating it. And many people are interested in this subject, and they ask me, you know, basically, are you in this alone? Do you believe this? Do you believe that? And the answer really is no, I to all those questions. We are not in this alone. And I don't necessarily believe anything when it comes to this theory. I am a scientist, and I look for facts and exploration, and I welcome the participation from other scientists in other genres, and such is the case. Scientists have proposed a radical new model for the makeup of the Earth's core, and this is just came out just this week on BBC News. Simon Redford, Redford put this wonderful article together. The study may explain a long-standing puzzle, a paradox, about the most inaccessible part of our planet, the inside. This study suggests that differences between the east and west hemispheres of the core are explained by the way iron atoms pack together. Really interesting experiment. It was details are in the journal Scientific Reports. Lying more than 5,000 kilometers beneath our feet at the center of the Earth, the core is beyond the reach of direct investigation. Broadly speaking, it consists of a solid sphere of metal sitting within a liquid outer core. That's the current theory. Again, it's just a theory, and it's based upon data that they are gaining from different kind of spectrographic measurements. The inner core started to solidify. It is estimated more than a billion years ago. It has a radius of about 1,220 kilometers, but it is growing. That's right. It is growing at the rate of about 0.5 millimeter each year. That's about a 16th of an inch, maybe a little less. But the stuff that the core is made from still remains a long-standing unresolved problem. They don't really know. Clues are what they're looking for, and they come from the speeds that seismic waves generated by earthquakes pass through the core. You know, when there's an earthquake on one of the atolls in the South Pacific, say 75 miles beneath the surface, it thumps the Earth pretty hard, and the vibrations pass through the planet, and they're picked up by other seismic listening stations. In effect, because of the way these listening stations are all tied together, we're doing a kind of large-scale CAT scan of the Earth. You've had a CAT scan before, haven't you? And you've been awake for it? Well, it's kind of interesting. If you get one, you'll notice vibrations. They vibrate low frequencies through your knee or your shoulder or whatever it is that they're looking at. Now, those vibrations vary in frequency, and they come from a source, and then they're picked up by sensors on the other side. And what they pick up are the reflections and the absorptions of these different structures in your body, the bone and the muscle and the tendon and openings and, you know, pustules and water and all kinds of things that might result from an injury. And they can tell the difference between them. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can identify it and say, well, that's bone, that's a tendon, unless they compare it to the other things around it, you see. It's not like they can just take out the tendon and say, oh, that's definitely the picture of a tendon. No, they have to compare it to the density of the muscle and the bone and the other tissue around it, the fat and different things. Then they can say, oh, yes, that's the tendon based on the contrast between this and other things. It's the same thing when they're measuring these vibrations go through the planet, except instead of going through a knee, they're going through about 7,000 miles of planet. And those waves can do all kinds of things in that 7,000 miles until they reach that listening station on the other side, or on the top or the bottom or left or right, or you get the picture. These tell us its density and also its elasticity. But the precise arrangement of iron atoms forming the crystalline core controls these numbers, okay? If it is a solid crystal, then it makes a certain frequency. If it's kind of a lump of, you know, white hot or blue hot iron, then it's quite something else. How those atoms are arranged remains unclear, but they're getting closer, since the conditions of extreme pressure and temperature at the core cannot be easily replicated in the laboratory. But it's interesting how they did it. Now, seismic data indicate that the western and eastern hemispheres of Earth's inner core are different, and this has led some to suggest that the core was once subject to an impulse, presumably from the collision of a space rock or a planetoid which shook the whole Earth, some sudden and cataclysmic event. The core, it is suggested, is constantly moving sideways. And as it does, the front side is melting and the rear side is crystallizing. But the core is held centrally in the middle of our planet by gravity. Now, not the gravity at the center of the planet, but the gravity of the crust, because it's pulling on it from all sides, so it keeps that core in the center of the planet, with some minor wobbling that we can see evidence of when we look at the magnetic field of the Earth. With all of these seismic complexities, the link between the crystal structure and the geophysical observations has yet to be resolved. They don't quite have all the pieces, but here's what they do have. In the publication Scientific Reports, Maurizio Mattesini from the Complutense University of Madrid, Spain, and colleagues proposed a novel possibility for the structure of the core. It's a little bit different than the Japanese structure proposal. It is composed of mixtures of different iron arrangements distinguished by the way their atoms pack together. By comparing seismic data from over 1,000 earthquakes across the globe with quantum mechanical modes for the properties of iron, they suggest that seismic variations directly reflect variations in the iron structure. That's probably a correct assumption. These spectrographical changes originate in very, I would say, large amplitude because of the huge volume of the core. And therefore, they constructively interfere and send a pretty clear signal, washing out all the noise, as it were. Now, they propose that the eastern and western sides of the core differ in the extent of mixing of these distinct structures and suggest their results account for the dynamic eastward drift of the core through time. That we have observed. Their complicated picture of the core contrasts with earlier suggestions. In a sense, they're sort of rewriting the Bible of planetary core geology / religiosity. Now, this is much to the chagrin of previous planetary core geologists who have argued, if not in their silence, in their stoic support for this theory. But it does suggest a more uniform mineralogy. That is to say, the core is pretty much iron. It's not mixed with nickel and aluminum and other things like that, which means it can pretty much be a crystal. Now, their complicated picture of the core, it does contrast with what we already know. But Dr. Arwin Deuce, a seismologist from the University of Cambridge, commented, "This is a step in the right direction, directly comparing seismology with mineral physical properties." In other words, they're using seismology as a spectrograph. She added that it should eventually provide a better understanding of the birth and evolution of our planet. And hopefully, it will add some support to the idea that we do not live on this bubbly, molten ball in space, but that the Earth has distinct structures. It has a solid core, maybe surrounded by some liquid molten parts, and that gravity is holding that molten part against the core, which is rotating inside a solid crust, and that there is some kind of lower density gap between the crust and the core, and that counter rotation is what makes our planet so powerful in its magnetic form. Now, these Stanford researchers say that they have conducted a pretty decent experiment of how to duplicate this. Now, see if you can visualize this. They use a diamond anvil cell. Now, this is kind of like, I want you to picture two artificial diamonds on the end of hardened steel ink pens, okay? Like you have diamond ballpoint pins. And behind these pins on either side are hydraulic rams, huge ones that can deliver a lot of pressure. And what they do is they take iron and they put it in between the diamond balls on the two ink pins, and then they squeeze the iron at pressures as high as 3 million times that felt at sea level in order to recreate the conditions at the absolute center of the Earth. The findings could refine theories on how the planet and its core evolved. Now, here's what they did. And these are two women. A postdoctoral researcher, Ariana Gleason, and Wendy Mao. They're the ones that built this experiment. Now, what they say is that the massive ball of iron sitting at the center of the Earth is not quite as rock solid as has been thought, as was published by the Japanese about a year and a half ago. By conducting experiments that simulate the immense pressures deep in the planet's interior, these two scientists were able to determine that iron in the Earth's core is only about 40% as strong as previous studies estimated. In other words, it's not a solid crystal, not hard like that. And this is the first time scientists have been able to experimentally measure the effects of such intense pressure. As I said, 3 million times that at sea level. The strength of iron under these extreme pressures is actually surprisingly weak. The strength measurement can help us understand how the core deforms over long timescales, which influences how we think about Earth's evolution and planetary evolution in general. Now, the way the experiment was set up, is they squeeze the iron, and then they heat it up with a laser to about 6,000 degrees C. That's approximately the temperature of the sun. And let's see here. They conducted their experiments using a diamond anvil cell, a device that can exert immense pressure on tiny samples clenched between the two diamonds. They subjected minute amounts of pure iron to pressures between 200 and 300 billion pascals. Okay, that's about 2 million to 3 million Earth atmospheres. An atmosphere is about 14.7 pounds per square inch. So you get the picture. Previous experimental studies were conducted in the range of only 10 gigapascals, but this is 200 and 300, 30 times as much. Now, she says, we really pushed the limit here in terms of experimental conditions. Pioneering advancements in pressure generation techniques and improvements in detector sensitivity, for example, used at large X-ray synchrotron facilities such as Argonne National Labs. In addition to their intense pressures now, the inner core also has extreme temperatures. The boundary between the inner and outer core has temperatures comparable to the surface of the sun, which, as I said, is about 6,000 degrees centigrade. Simultaneously simulating both the pressure and the temperature at the inner core isn't quite possible in the lab. Okay, but they can get close. Gleason and Mao expect their findings will help other researchers set more realistic variables for conducting their own experiments. While they're pressurizing this amount to and heating it to 6,000 degrees, they exposed it to X-rays. Let's see here if I can get down here. Oh, here we go. Measurements in early 1990s of iron melting curves from which the Earth's from the core's temperature can be deduced, suggested a core temperature about 5,000 degrees C. Other people made other measurements and calculations with computers, and nothing was in agreement. It was not good for our field that we didn't agree with each other. The core temperature is crucial to a number of disciplines that study regions of our planet's interior that will never be accessed directly, so they say, guiding our understanding of everything from earthquakes to the Earth's magnetic field. That's why they don't understand. That's why the textbooks are so confusing, because the sciences that have been studying this can't agree. Now, Dr. DeWale says, we have to give answers to geophysicists, seismologists, geodynamicists. They need some data to feed their computer models. Now, I have to tell you, being a former academician myself and a longtime commercial scientist, it is rare, it is more rare for academicians to step outside their own discipline. They are experts, to be sure, but they're experts in their little thimble of technology. Once you step outside that realm, once you get out of the thimble onto the table, they're no longer experts, and they don't claim to be experts. Now, commercial scientists have to wear more hats. Once they get outside their area of expertise, they pick up a manual and start reading. There's no pride to it. We have to solve the problem. We have to produce the product. Metallurgists and materials engineers and packaging engineers, we have to get along. We have to talk. We have to think about each other's sciences so that we can fit everything together and make something affordable and functional that you can buy. But academicians are a little bit different. Now, they have to coordinate. So these geophysicists, seismologists, geodynamicists, and even cosmologists must come together and think about the results. Well, not the results. What we call empirical data. That's the stuff that you can see, the real result that you can actually detect and record. And then we start going into the why do we see this? Why does this variation happen? Why does this force exist? And in a cross-disciplined manner, it's easier to solve. But the team has now revisited those 20-year-old measurements, making use of the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, one of the world's most intense sources of X-rays, to replicate the enormous pressures at the core boundary. More than a million times the pressure at sea level, they use the device called the Diamond Anvil Cell. It's essentially a tiny sample held between two points of precision machine synthetic diamonds, hardest thing known to man. Once the team's iron samples were subjected to the high pressures and high temperatures using a laser to heat it up, the scientists used X-ray beams to carry out diffraction, bouncing X-rays off the nuclei of the iron atoms and watching how the pattern changed as the iron changed from solid to liquid. Now, the way that this actually occurs is the X-rays, as you know, are very, very short wavelength photons. As these photons go slamming into these iron structures, they penetrate into the lower electron shells and they sputter off electrons. And that is to say, it's sort of like a cue ball hitting the two ball and knocking it out of the way. The interesting thing that occurs is that the electrons in the higher orbitals will fall to the lower energy state inside to fill in the place where you knock that two ball out. That fall creates a photon of its own. It's called fluorescing. And that photon can be measured. Now, when you measure that photon, it is absolutely idiosyncratic to that element. You could tell exactly the oxidation state and the source of that that atom, whether it's iron or alumina or whatever, gold, tin. You can identify it exactly based on that frequency. That's why this X-ray fluorescent spectroscopy is so important. Those diffraction patterns give more insight into partially molten states of iron, which the team believes were what the researchers were measuring in the first experiments. And this is fascinating stuff, but it's taking place in a laboratory. And what it suggests is that the core is not at 5,000 degrees C. It's at 6,000 degrees C. Give or take 500 degrees C, roughly that of the sun's surface. Sound familiar? An inner sun? Well, there you go. And the team leader, Dr. DeWale, says now everything agrees. Pretty fascinating stuff. Pretty fascinating stuff. Don't forget, we got about 10 minutes, and we have Don Margolis coming on the program. Now, he has his own program every Friday at 5 p.m. Pacific time on the BBS Radio Network, and he is talking about the truth about stem cells. Now, you've heard about stem cells in the news from time to time. We've talked, we've heard about fetal stem cells. We've heard about what they kind of do, but it's largely a mystery to the general public. We fall to the advertising, you know, part of it. We don't really know the basics of it. It can be said of biology, and it has been said by many, that everything is actually biochemistry. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about living cells, and you're talking about the physiology of bodies and systems, endocrine systems and electrical systems and, you know, all the balanced things in the body that keep it working, from digestion to the nervous system to the muscles and the bones, and somehow we keep it all together and live for 100 years. Well, how that all begins, really, a sperm and an egg and a hormone called hyaluronidase, and how those two separate cells then become one cell and begin to form a zygote and later a fetus. It's kind of interesting how that all patterns out. That is to say, we start out with two cells, but somehow those two cells expand to four, and then, you know, eight, and then on and on and on. We get the human body formed. But the human body is made of bone and muscle and nerve and eye tissue and a brain. And how does each cell know how to differentiate? And since we're only starting with a small number of cells, eventually we're several hundred million cells made up of thousands of different proteins made by a small number of genes. How does all that know? Well, the root of it all, from a biological point of view, a biochemical point of view, is the stem cell. The stem cell is the cell that can differentiate into anything. Tooth and bone and eye tissue and liver, heart and spleen and fingernail. Everything stems from that cell. That's why it's called a stem cell. Now, man, especially those that are fascinated with extending life, curing disease, etc., has become very fascinated with the stem cell and its manipulation and its harvesting. And we have played with the ethics of it, since we do see it more naturally in fetal tissues. We have created these fetuses, frozen them at very early stages of development when they're quote-unquote not really a living thing, and we've harvested those cells and experimented on them. But that's only my brief understanding of the subject, and you realize that there are ethics here that go to the very core of humanity. For instance, let's just think objectively for a moment about the subject of abortion. Right now, we kill about 1.3 million babies a year in this country, give or take a little bit, sometimes a million and sometimes as high as 1.3 million. Now, it's worse in other countries, I can tell you that. There are 50 million females missing in countries like India. Why is that? Why are the females missing? Well, because an amniocentesis or a ultrasound can determine the sex of the baby at a very early stage. If the sex of the baby is determined to be a female, it is often aborted. And that's why there are 50 million females missing in India. I don't know how many females are missing in the United States, but I can tell you as a statistician and as a student of the subject, most of the abortions in this country are performed for birth control. And it is unfortunate, but many of the wealthy who are having the abortions are aborting their children not because they're deformed, not because they don't want a baby. It's because they want the baby. They kill their babies because they're the wrong sex. I don't know any other way to put it. Yes, it's a woman's choice. That's the law of the land, but that's what it is. Now, certainly there are ethical questions about that because legislators have no right to legislate what a woman does and blah, blah, blah. You got that part. I understand that. But you have labs around the world that are fertilizing female eggs using harvested sperm and creating the beginnings of that fetus before it attaches itself to the placenta while it's still falling from the tubes and heading for the cervical wall. Inside of that is a question as to whether it is life or whether it is potential life. However, the value of those cells has become a gold mine. And that's why civilized countries, developed countries, have made all kinds of laws which labs are supposed to be obeying that say we're not going to farm human fetuses. We're not going to have factories that create freeze-dried little babies to sell to research labs. You understand the ethics of this, right? This is drives the very emotion of the human soul into this science. Now you have scientists who may or may not believe in the human soul, may or may not believe in God, and they're driven by two different motivations. One is, of course, to make that breakthrough and conquer disease or age or to be able to cure people. The other is money. It's just plain and simple. It's money. And we're not talking about millions of dollars. We're talking about trillions of dollars. That's right. When you have very, very powerful people who want to live, they will put unlimited amounts of money behind this science. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little Alice Band, and we'll be right back with Don Margolis. Don't go away. Phone lines will be open, but please, when you call in on the subject matter, okay? We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. Don Margolis coming on the program right after this.
BBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge bringing humanity closer to truth. BBSradio.com.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Welcome to Hour 2. Our special guest is Don Margolis. As I've said, he has his own radio program on the BBS Radio Network on Friday at 5 p.m. on Channel 2. That's Pacific Daylight Time this year. And we welcome Don Margolis. We're going to talk about stem cells. It's very fascinating and mysterious subject, and also very technical. Welcome to the program, Don.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this for a week, and I can't wait to get started.
All right. Well, this is going to be great. Now, one of the things that we're going to kind of divide these 2 hours into three areas. The first area, we're going to talk about actual patient treatment using this technology. We have a couple of patients we're going to talk about. Absolutely fascinating results, just so that you know how powerful this area of research is and how great the temptations are to deal with it. Okay, Don, let's talk about your patient study.
Okay. As you know, I started the very first stem cell company in the world to actually treat patients, and we started commercially in 2005 treating heart patients. And one of our first patients, I call her, for purposes of anonymity, I'm going to call her Lady Cal. She's from California, and she was in her middle to late 50s, and she had been seeing her cardiologist, and every time she went to see her cardiologist, he sent her in for an angioplasty, which means to put stents in her body. And this angioplasty, and every time. Now, it's an expensive treatment, in the area, some as high as $10,000, usually around $5,000 to $7,000. And
explain to us what a stent is. What do they do? They go in with a catheter, and what do they do?
Well, this is only for patients who have blockage in their coronary arteries. Back 25 years or so ago, they were just simple metal tubes, which were about the size of the artery, and they connected, they snipped the artery and then put the tube between the two pieces of the artery so the blood could flow through where it was being blocked before. And blocked arteries is very dangerous for heart patients. It can lead to a heart attack, but it always leads to heart failure because the heart doesn't get enough blood to properly work. And like any muscle, when the heart doesn't get enough action, it doesn't cause enough action. Like any muscle, it gets bigger and bigger in order to do this job. And big hearts is something cardiologists hate for very good reason. So the stent was supposed to allow blood to flow where it didn't flow before, where it was blocked. Well, what they didn't realize, and some might say they should have realized, is the stents got blocked just as fast as the arteries got blocked. The plaque came in, stuffed it up, and stopped the blood. Well, it took them quite a long time to get a solution to it, let's say about 15 years, and now we're into the early to mid-90s, and they come up with something called drug-eluting stents, eluting, which meant that these stents had drugs on them, and those drugs prevented the coagulation of the blood and the blockage. And for that purpose, they worked longer. They didn't stop altogether, but it did work longer. And that's, we'll get into more details of that later, but this is what Lady Cow was getting.
So now, this is kind of a mechanical solution. There's really no cure to this.
Not kind of, exactly a mechanical solution, yes.
It's delaying the inevitable.
Yes. So she went in there, and she was feeling really bad, weak, short of breath, blah, 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 the typical condition of advanced heart patients. Her well, it was coronary artery disease. And he said, well, it looks like you need an angioplasty. And she knew this because every time she went in there, he gave her an angioplasty. He made a thousand or two on references and on the reference to the hospital to do the angioplasty, and he would get some commissions on his prescription drugs. And Lady Cal was smart enough to know she wasn't getting any better. And so she went onto the internet and she found our website. Now, this is, we started in 03, but we treated our first patients in 05, and she found us in May of 05, and we communicated in June, and she made an appointment to come in for stem cells in July. And she came in, a really interesting lady, and got her treatment, and she was home about a month, and she was already feeling better. And at the two-month mark, she did something she hadn't done in 10 years, which was vacuum her whole entire downstairs. And she admitted, I had to stop a time or two to catch my breath and to rest for a minute, but it's the first time I've been able to do this in over 10 years. Then, at the third month, she went to visit her cardiologist. And he did not recognize her.
Really?
She had gone from gray, hold my head down, to bouncing in and saying, here I am. And he didn't want to hear. He told her those drugs he gave her and that angioplasty, the 25th angioplasty, finally worked, according to him. And but she laughed, and every year she wrote to us about her progression. And she didn't stop progressing. At least 4 or 5 years she was progressing before it leveled off.
And this is after just one short series of treatment, or were you treating her for the whole 5 years?
Exactly. What it was they squirted the stem cells into the coronary arteries, all three of them, and since the coronary arteries are right virtually inside the heart at some point, what they did was they created little detours where the blockage was. They didn't go through the blockage. They created detours, and the blood went into the heart without going through those arteries, and the heart processed them and sent it on its way.
So it was like a natural bypass. It was a natural bypass.
I wish I had thought of that word earlier, natural bypass. But, yes, you're absolutely right. Well, every year she writes in and tells how she's doing, and it may interest you to know that next week will be her 8th anniversary, and we don't have anybody in her shape that's gone 8 years. And this, in the face of what all of your medical doctors who are so-called experts on stem cells and tell you that they don't work, like one cat at the University of Pennsylvania says, they only last 4 months. And except in Lady Cow's case and hundreds of others, they last much longer than 4 months. And that's Lady Cal.
The next patient, yeah. And then we'll get into the where's and how's and why this happened.
Okay. Mr. Illinois was in his late 60s. He was told that at a certain point, and this was in our second year of operation, that his cardiologist gave him an honest appraisal. He said, there's nothing we can do to help you, an absolute truth, and you're too old to get a transplant, another absolute truth. And so, Mr. Illinois, we suggest you go home, get your affairs in order, and prepare. And which he did. He turned his company over to his survivors and went home and relaxed with his gorgeous 50-year-old girlfriend and just was a couch potato and reading when 30 or 40 days into the 3 months, he got an email from his cousin with our website on and say, take a look at this website and give him a call, which he did. Now, he's a very wealthy fellow, and it took him absolutely no time to get every piece of medical information from his doctors to our doctors in Bangkok. And he was the doctor who was actually going to perform the procedure told him that you're going to have to sign a document because there's a 20% chance you won't get off the table. And the guy said, that's the best chance I've had. And he took it immediately, came in, had the procedure. The procedure worked. And then right after the procedure was finished, he went into a coma. And his family flew over to be with him in the event. And but in 4 days, he woke up. And on day seven, he was walking around the hospital. And day 10, he was begging to be allowed to go home. They let him go, I believe it was at the end of 2 weeks, and he went back home. It was about 2 months later that I heard from somebody in his family that his gorgeous 50-year-old girlfriend had left him. And I asked, why would she leave him? He's back and he's healthy. And she says, well, I came to take care of him for better or for worse, but not for sex 7 days a week. that's the story of Mr. Illinois. He survived 5 years and died of some non-cardiological disease, and he had five of the best years of his life. And now on, back to you.
All right. So now we have these two patients. We have nothing short of stunning, I'm going to say, regression back to a more youthful state. It wasn't necessarily a cure of what was already there, but it helps the body work around limitations that it has by allowing it to regenerate or to newly generate new tissues, new arteries, and to help that person to a better state of health.
I couldn't have said it better myself. You said what most people don't know to say. Stem cells are not a cure. And most people have trouble with that statement, but you don't. Continue, please.
Well, I mean, the thing about the human body is, you know, when we're young, we're indestructible. We get run over by a car and we bounce right back up, you know, different things like that. But as you get older, your skin loses its elasticity. You realize, gee, I can't run that marathon anymore. I can't hold my breath as long as I used to. I bend down to put my socks on and tie my shoes and I have to stand up and take a couple of deep breaths. And you're going, hey, what the heck's going on here? What happens is the human body doesn't recover as quickly. The older you get, the more profound that becomes. Now, it can be because of the energy level of those cells as they divide and replace themselves over time. But the basic law is that the cells have forgotten how to differentiate. Muscles can regenerate muscles, of course. Skin regenerates skin, of course. But the actual stem cells of the bodies have kind of forgotten who and what they are. And so when something gets old, like your kidneys or your liver or your heart or your bladder, it's done. You need a transplant or a replacement. Somehow the body has to remember how to make those new cells. Now here's the big question. These two patients, did they have one treatment or did they go through years of treatments? Just one treatment with the stem cells and then their body in that particular spot remembered how to make new cells?
It's an easy question to answer. Lady Cal, the answer is absolutely yes, one treatment. Mr. Illinois was looking for ways to get younger after his heart was fixed. He wanted to get younger and he went in for anti-aging stem cells. So, and I don't think they hurt him, but he was living quite an active life, a very active life. So the answer is I don't count anti-aging stem cells as a second treatment. If you went in, there are people that quite properly go in for a second heart treatment. Of all the people the six people that are on my list, every one of them, one treatment.
Well, now the next question is, and this has already been pinged to me by a couple of my loyal listeners out there through Skype. Where did the stem cells come from? From that person? From fetal tissue? What is the mystery behind stem cells? Do you order them from Stem Cells RS, or do you make them? Where did they come from?
Okay, for the early years, they came from the patient's bone marrow or the patient's blood. Now, if they came from the patient, the bone marrow feeds the blood stem cells. Bone marrow has a plentiful supply, so a doctor with a needle can take the entire bone marrow out of the hip and wash them off and put them right into the patient with a needle or usually with a catheter. So, yes, the answer is the number one source has always been what we call from the patient himself, autologous. I won't spell it, but it's pronounced autologous, meaning mm-hmm. from the patient himself. The third and fourth things to come along was what we call adipose from the patient's tummy fat after a mini lipo. And before we know it, there are all sorts of places where stem cells are coming from. But they found that umbilical cord stem cells, that is, a healthy baby is born, they snip off the umbilical cord, they squeeze the blood out, they test the blood for disease, and if it is not infected, they can use that to create some of the more powerful stem cells. So that's the fourth thing that came along, is umbilical cord stem cells. Now, in 2013, that's also followed by more afterbirth called placenta, and they make powerful stem cells. So there's all your sources, all of them autologous from the patient or from the birth of healthy newborns. Those are the only two we would consider. We do never consider embryonic because they kill people, and we would never consider fetus because we don't need to kill fetuses, it's usually in the 13th week, to get very good stem cells.
Right, and that's one of the ethical questions that I discussed a couple times on the program. And when people think about stem cells, the first thing they get is the heebie-jeebies because they think, oh my gosh, you know, they're farming, they're creating these fetuses and then they're freeze-drying them and they're extracting cells from them and throwing away the rest in order to keep the living living. Well, the ethical questions go beyond the pale. And we don't have a trouble killing our own babies by the millions. We abort them all the way up to the time before they start spewing amniotic fluid out their nose. No compunction whatsoever. But fetal stem cells, harvesting fetuses to harvest stem cells is just beyond the ethical pale, and science, at least civilized science, is not going to do that. I'm not saying there aren't some labs out there doing it, because we all know better. When there's enough money behind the science, anything is possible. But the idea is, and we've brought this up a couple of times on this program, that there are individuals on this planet who have enough power and enough money. They want to live, and they don't want to just vegetatively live. They want to live dynamically. They want to be dynamic leaders. We've noticed a couple of our politicians in recent years that have become old and haggard, and we think, oh, gee, they're done. And I say, and I know you'll go with me with this on Don, they're not done. You let them sit out for a couple of years, get a couple of facials, get their hair redone, lose about 100 pounds, and get some stem cell treatments, and they will be back with more power and more charisma than you can imagine.
I certainly go along with you there. No matter how depressed you can get, usually if you can get rid of the mental depression, you stem cells will get you back into the real world, usually. Stem cells are not a magic bullet. There's a lot more you have to do, but the answer to your question is yes.
Well, one of the things that we know from a biochemical point of view is there are not enough genes in the human makeup to account for all the proteins that make up the human body. We've observed this in countless numbers of identical twins as they morphologically change. They become differentiated over time. And it's not because they're not eating the same things or wearing the same things or even living in the same neighborhood. It's because of the consciousness that's inside that being. That's what's changing the proteins that those genes are manufacturing. They may look the same, and they may genetically be identical, but the proteins those genes make are up to the consciousness of the being that's in it.
That's a subject I am not strong on, so I won't comment.
Outside the thimble. I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's right. I loved your thimble definition. Boy, do I see that. I see that every day.
We have a specialized science here of not just stem cell research, but stem cell treatment of humans. Now, your company has been around now for 8 or 9 years, actively doing not only research, but also treatment.
Yes, especially heart, but now we're expanding into about 100 different diseases.
Yeah, diseases typically attack tissues or diminish the body's ability to make things like insulin and other kinds of hormones and even proteins that make up the multifunctions of the liver or the functionality of the kidneys. And I guess the Frankenstein way that we've solved it is we just take living tissue from another human being, put it inside the human being that has the bad organ, give them anti-rejection drugs, which lowers their immune system, so they actually have other problems like susceptibility to pneumonia and infections, and they have to live a somewhat abbreviated life, and they don't really live a full life after that. They live better, but not a full life. Now we've got stem cell treatments that mean that a transplant is not necessary. So what are the ethics that go with this? What's the truth about the future of stem cells in human society?
Well, if you were to ask me that if you and I were running it, what we could expect is first in the raw stem cell area, continued progression because it's still in its infancy, even though that over 50,000 people have been treated already. But the addition of genetics and stem cells is coming along rather rapidly. The joining up with nanotechnology is just beginning. And so we are still at the raw beginning. And if you and I were running it, it would just progress normally. However, you and I aren't running it. The whole medical system of the entire world is being run by Nazi corporations. And they do what they want to do. Ethics be damned. Nothing matters but profits. And rule number one is profits are all that matters. Rule number two is when in doubt, refer to rule number one. And rule number three, patients are lab rats whose only job is to buy our products and die young. That is the actual system, and the system is not going to change in my lifetime. Of course, I'm a lot older than you. It's not going to change in my lifetime, and I doubt that it's going to change in yours, no matter what you or I say or anything else, because these people own everything. They own all the medical doctors in the world. When I say all, let's say 90%. They own all the medical scientists. If you're a medical scientist, most of your money comes from big medicine, mostly big pharma. And if you're a medical university, and especially a big one like Harvard or Stanford or Penn or Johns Hopkins, you do what pharma tells you to do, and you very cheerfully take their money. You don't do what you know is right. I know a lot of doctors are going to hate that statement, but the proof is right out there when you see the lies put out by the major medical journals. Stem cells for the heart last 4 months, no longer. Don't just tell that to Lady California. or tell that to the 5 years of wildlife the 70-something lived after his treatment. So that's the system. The system says tell the people lies and tell the doctors lies. Pharma companies tell the doctors what to say when a patient asks if they should get stem cells. And the doctors are given some cock and bull story to tell the patients. Come, I know we haven't helped you very much in the last 8 years. You've gotten progressively worse. But try this new pill. It just came out. And this new pill, the side effects have been hidden because that's the current law. Companies are allowed to hide side effects, especially keep them from doctors. Not that any doctors care. I've got a document that was taken in Southern California, right outside Scripps, where two researchers proved absolutely that doctors not only don't know what side effects are, they don't care what side effects are. And when the patients that they interviewed to see if they what they thought about side effects in their doctors, they screamed at the interviewer about how their doctor stood there tapping his pencil and not paying attention as they were telling them the horrible effects of statins. And that's the system. So getting back to your original question, I don't see any progress coming. And what most people don't know is right now there's a law being cruising its way through the Senate, which is saying giving the FDA the right to do whatever it wants. Right up to now, they've had only the right to call stem cells that come from your own body a drug. But they say if you just take the stem cells from your bone marrow and put it right back in, that's okay. Now the Senate, since the Senate is owned by the same billionaires, is now going to pass a law, and it's going to be at least 85%, is going to say, FDA, do whatever you want to stop stem cells, because stem cells could possibly interfere with profits, and we can't allow that to happen. So make up anything you want to do, say anything you want to say, but stem cells have to go.
Now, what is the ethical propaganda that we're going to hear about stem cells? The Senate's going to...
That they don't work, that they're unproven. They just say that knowing that they are proven, but as long as they say it, nobody's going to contradict them. They control all the newspapers. If the New York Times were to print that stem cells really work and they are proven, bingo, they're out of business because they don't get any pharma ads. That goes for any major newspaper in North America. You don't go along with the game, you don't get their ads.
We run into that in other industries too, like Time Magazine.
Oh, I'm shocked to hear that, Doctor. I'm shocked to hear that.
Like Time Magazine drove the Tesla and they made it fail and it had to be towed, and the guy wrote a scathing article and Tesla's stock dropped by 10%. But the guys at Tesla were smart. They had a black box in the car. And they recorded everything that Time Magazine reporter did to abuse that car. And then they published their own article. And it was so exposing to the Time Magazine market making that their stock went up 25%. And when it did, it caught the naked short traders and they had to start buying the stock. And now the stock's up over $120. And I predict it's going to go to $150. Now, the same thing can happen in the stem cell industry. Of course, the FDA is bought and paid for, and officials from the FDA and Big Pharma, whether you're talking about Pfizer or Libby or Merck or these other companies, guess where they go? They go right back into the Senate. They are the policymakers. They are the lobbyists that buy those Ferraris and those golf trips and those, well, whatever else senators get as a payment. And that's why they can do or say anything that they want, and real cures are excoriated while drug treatments are advertised every 15 minutes on every TV channel you want to watch. Now, Don, I'm at a loss here. I remember when I was a kid, you could see cigarette commercials on TV. You know, Lucky Strike and Pall Mall and Marlboro. I mean, they all had their commercials, even though we knew cigarettes were killing people. Now we have drug advertisements. Ask your doctor about this one or that one. And the side effects are, by the way, if you have thoughts of killing someone, see your doctor right away. What in the world are we doing? Susie Homemaker is going into her doctor and saying, "Doctor, I saw a commercial on TV, and it asked me to ask you about this new bone drug that I can take once a day, and it'll keep me from having osteoporosis." What the heck is going on, Don, that patients are going into their doctors with advertisements? This is a cinch the doctors aren't watching those commercials.
Well, it's a cinch that the doctors are getting commissions for selling those drugs. 80% of the American doctors earn commissions for selling drugs, which is why they don't care about side effects. Sell the drug. Some of them are really sharp. They set up a pharmacy next door to their medical office, and they say, take this prescription to Joe's Pharmacy next door, and which is owned by the same doctor. And so they make double. They get the doctor's commission from the drug company and the profits on the drug itself from the pharmacy.
Oh, absolutely. The doctor.
So that is the medical system. And as I started this off with doctor, I said this is the most corrupt medical system in the world. Nothing is as corrupt as a system which has cost more than 50% more than almost every other country. We spend 18% on doctors, hospitals, and medical insurance companies, medical machinery, 18% of our national income, 18%. And the average European company spends 10%. And where does that money go? It goes to profits. It doesn't go to increased patients.
And now this year I went to do my taxes in March, and I went in, and my tax guy says, "By the way, next year, if you don't have government-approved health care, you're going to be fined $285 per person in your family. You're going to be
fined." Yes, well, that's because people think there's an Obama tax law and there's a Republican tax law. Nothing could be further from the truth. Both of those tax laws were written by big business. Both of those tax laws that they're arguing about, and they keep the argument going just to confuse the people, it has nothing to do with Obama. It has nothing to do with the Republicans. Both laws are written by big pharma, big medicine. And whatever it is, whatever the law is, the only purpose of the law is to increase profits so that they can take more than 18% of our total income and put it into medicine. I'm going to read you the opening paragraph of an article that came out this week. "Despite a level of health expenditures that would have seemed unthinkable a generation ago, the health of the USA population has improved only gradually and has fallen behind the pace of progress in many other wealthy nations. Dr. Harvey Fineberg of the Institute of Medicine in Washington, D.C., wrote in an editorial published on Wednesday with the study in the Journal of the American Medical Association." There it is, right there in the country's number one medical journal, the Journal of the American Medical Association. There it is. It says we're spending too much money and getting fewer results. What does that mean? It means profits are first and patients are last. Yet the people, like the lady you said, walking in with the advertisement, they have been so brainwashed that MD means medical deity and God knows best. And that's why I'm going in there. Now, from my experience, it looks like there's somewhere between 15 and 20% who know otherwise. But the vast majority know what this lady knows. I have to take my advertisement into my doctor so he can make his commission on a drug that's never been proven and doesn't work and may hurt me.
But, Don, Sally Field says it was okay.
Well, sure, but Suzanne Somers doesn't.
Ah, that's right. So what is happening globally? Now, we know Big Pharma in the United States, and we know that a lot of people are ordering the same drug from the same manufacturer out of Canada, mail order, and they're getting it like at 80% discount. We also know that a lot of people are going to Costa Rica for elective surgery instead of staying in this country to get the elective surgery. What's going on globally in the medical community? Because we really have a global society that's not particularly owned by Big Pharma.
Well, what's happening is the rich Arabs in the Middle East are not coming to the United States anymore. They're going to Bangkok and Singapore, which are the best choices. Some fantastic hospitals in Bangkok, which put American hospitals to shame as far as treatment is concerned. And that's one thing. Another is that there are stem cell clinics all over the world surviving despite all the lies that people are forced to read on radio and television and their local newspaper, and the doctors are forced to read in their medical journals. Some people say, when I make claims like this, I say, well, prove it, Margolis, prove it. I say, well, I can't prove that doctors are shoving money in, pharma is shoving money into doctors' pockets because I'm not there when they get it. And I'm not sure, I can't prove that Harvard University and Stanford University are profiting by hundreds of millions of dollars by playing the kill the patient game. That I can prove to you because, we won't go, it'll take too long here. But I have one fact that when people say this is not true, in the year 2002 and 2003, the three major medical journals, New England Journal, Nature, and Science, between them or among them, published one very positive article about adult stem cells every month, 2002, 2003. January 1st, 2004, pharma came out with a new law. Now, it wasn't passed by Congress, but it doesn't matter. If they wanted it passed by Congress, they would have. But the law was this. Anybody who publishes an article, a positive article about stem cells, about adult stem cells, in a medical journal, in a newspaper, on radio or television, will not be supported by pharma and will most likely go out of business.
Sure.
So, for the next full 8 years, 2004 to 2011 inclusive, they averaged less than one article, positive article about adult stem cells every 2 years in those medical journals. I'll say it again. They went from one positive article a month to a half a year, or a 24th of an article every month. 1/24th of an article every month.
And the main reason is because they don't control the source, they don't control the patents, they can't make any money on it, and they can't prevent competition.
That's correct. It's very tough to compete with the patient's own body. So it's not a very profitable product, and since profits are all that matters in medicine, everything is being done to tell the suckers it doesn't work, and the suckers believe it, and everything is being done to harm those that are treating. Now, what pharma did effective in 2004, 2005, they did two major things. They supported this corrupt thing in California called CIRM, the Center for Regenerative Medicine, which was started by a guy, and he, I won't use names here, but it was started by a guy, a businessman who found a way to make millions of dollars for himself and his friends by stealing $6 million from the taxpayers of a state that is literally broken. And they say, we're going, they advertised that they're going to do stem cell research, and as soon as George Bush leaves the White House, cures are going to be pouring out of the pipeline. Well, of course, it was a lie. Here's this guy. He was virtually crying when he was discussing this wonderful institution to come up with stem cell cures. He says, my son has diabetes, and I want him to get a cure. Well, the guy is a huge crook, and he knew, and so does every doctor in the state of California, that adult stem cells had already treated and proven themselves to treat and improve the lives of diabetics. but my son has diabetes and I want embryonic stem cells. Well, what happened was this crooked organization only supported embryonic stem cells, not the stem cells that work, but the stem cells that kill. So naturally, a few years went by, and then something happened. There was a the first thing that happened was the first person they put in charge of this, that the fraudulent businessman, the first person he put in charge left. He says, "I can't do this anymore. I'm quitting." He knew it was crooked, and he didn't want to be parts of it. So they found a lady to take his place. Well, she knew why the first guy quit, so she was going to straighten things out herself. She found out she had no power, even though she was titled the president. And next thing you know, she quit. Now, here they were. So they have a whole state of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of medical doctors and researchers, and they couldn't find one crook to run this operation. So they went across the country. They went to New York. They went to New England, where there was a lot of support for embryonic stem cells, and they couldn't find a crook. They could only find honest doctors. Then somebody tipped them off. There was a crook available in Australia. And so this crook in Australia had been caught twice by the newspapers. First time, a reporter asked him, a reporter in the city of Adelaide, asked him, "I hear that laboratory animals were killed by the hundreds in embryonic stem cell research." "Oh, no, 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 no. There's no animal has ever been killed in embryonic research." And the second time, he released some figures showing how wonderful embryonic stem cells were in this study that his organization controlled or ran.
Ah.
And he was the boss of this organization, and it was exposed to be a fraud. This guy was perfect. He was perfect, and they hired him and pay him twice as much as the governor pays to be a crooked liar for the CIRM in California. And he's still there making twice as much as the governor, and they're trying to get more money out of the broken state of California. Then the funniest thing was about 5 years ago, as you know, Democrats love embryonic stem cells. They're not smart enough to know that they can never work. And Republicans aren't smart enough to turn the argument around in their favor. So the legislature, which was Democratic, and the governor, as you well know, the governator, was a Republican. So a Democrat in the state's legislature, her name was Sheila, her first name, I forget her last name, it was too many years ago, but Sheila said, "We believe in the legislature that," and this is Democrats who were supposed to be embryonic, "that adult stem cells should be researched too under CIRM, okay?
What happened?
And here comes the governor who says, "Our voters voted for embryonic stem cells in Proposition 71. Now, it was a pure lie. Nothing in Proposition said anything about embryonic stem cells. It said stem cells. But the governor, whose friends controlled all the press in the state of California, including the Los Angeles Times, never mentioned a word that he was lying. I mean, didn't they have one little copy clerk that could look at Proposition 71 and say it didn't say embryonics? No, that wasn't the point. The point was to lie to the voters. And the voters believed them.
Now, why was it important for them to differentiate? Why do they stress embryonic stem cells?
Because that's where the money is. That's what pharma pays money for, to continue the embryonic hoax, which we haven't gotten into yet. But as I told you before, embryonic is not a science. It's science fiction at best. At worst, it's a pure fantasy. A fantasy which pharma very cleverly got the Democrats and Republicans to fight each other, got the churches to fight against the liberals, and it's all so meaningless. Embryonic stem cells will never be able to be put into a human being as adult stem cells are today. They will kill them for two reasons. Reason number one is that the body will start a war against the immune system will start a war against this stranger, this embryonic stem cell stranger. And reason number two, if you give them enough drugs to overcome that, then what happens when this very smart stem cell, the embryonic stem cell, says, okay, you trained me to do this job to fix the pancreas. I'm going to go fix the pancreas. And it goes and it fixes the pancreas and does a half-decent job, too. And then that embryonic stem cell says, well, I'm bored now. What am I going to do? Oh, yes, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a baby. And no matter, since it's not in a womb, not even in a fallopian tube, this thing starts growing.
Oh,
and what does it turn into? I don't have to tell you, do I?
Wow. Wow. So you're talking about unfertilized, and yet it goes off dividing and differentiating and going by the genetic pattern that it only knows.
Now, I didn't want to say this, but you just reminded me of the idiocy of the average embryonic scientist. It's 2 years, in 1998, two good doctors, embryonic a guy by the name of James Thompson in Wisconsin, and a lady at Duke University named Doris Taylor. Doris Taylor proved that adult stem cells work on animals, and James Thompson isolated the first embryonic stem cell. And 2 years, 3 years later, embryonic scientists would make the following statement. We left our embryonic stem cells in this container on the table, and we left next to it adult stem cells in the same type of container. And we came back the next morning, and the embryonic stem cells were going wild. They were growing. They were spilling out of the container. There were so many of them. And the adult stem cells were just staying there dead. Adult stem cells can't do anything. And the embryonic stem cells can do everything. And everything you read about embryonic stem cells makes some lie statement like that. Now, as you now know, if you learned in the last 5 minutes, those cells are looking to become a baby. And any place that lets them grow and multiply so that they think they're going to make a baby until they're not in a womb and nothing good is going to happen will continue to explode in numbers. Meanwhile, adult stem cells are there for one reason, to fix something that ain't broke. And nothing in that container is broke for them to fix, so they just lie there appearing to be dead.
Right.
And that is the science behind embryonic stem cells. The bubbles prove that embryonic stem cells are active, and the adult stem cells don't do anything. And that's how science developed in the embryonic field.
Well, I noticed an article in Drudge Report yesterday that scientists are getting close to several cures. That is to say, these are physiological defects, not diseases like you're catching a virus or something, but a physiological disease of the body, heart disease, liver disease, etc., using stem cells. But the article was kind of benign. It didn't go into details. It didn't describe whether it was adult or embryonic. It just said stem cells. And it was kind of, you know, the average reader just kind of went right over it. But I knew that you were coming on the program, so I read the article, and I was really trying to differentiate whether there was a breakthrough here or whether it was just an advertising piece. And I couldn't get anything from the article. Even though that your research, your clinic's research, and other clinics' research in other countries is doing really breakthrough stuff and has clinical proof, actual patient care proof that these systems work, we're not seeing the publications. We're not seeing peer review. We're not seeing I know a lot of our listeners know what peer review is, but this means that other scientists in your science admit your paper into a major publication like Science or the AMA or something like that, and then they sort of vouch for it. That's what a peer review paper is. But you have the living, breathing patients out there, the John Does and the Mrs. California. You've got these people living and breathing, walking around.
Well, if that's a question, which I'll take it as a question, let's start in 2006 when our Israeli researchers wrote a paper, and in the paper said that we realize that the embryonic scientists say that adults themselves can't do much of anything. Here is proof that they can become almost everything. And step-by-step proof, which they did themselves. And they submitted this to Nature and Science and New England Journal, and they never got a response. Not even a polite response. Well, one of them did say, yes, we, our peer review said that this is not true, or there's not enough, not they didn't say it wasn't true, they said there's not enough proof. And so, and they couldn't believe it because the whole thing was full of proof. And they then offered it to the British Journal of Hematology, which took them 2.5 minutes to accept it. And next thing they know, they were published in the British Journal of Hematology. That was followed by similar articles over the next 2-3 years from all over the world, where they're saying, here's what we've done with bone marrow stem cells. But that didn't stop the corrupt system. That did not stop Science, the journal, Nature, the journal, from saying into 2012, bone marrow stem cells are only able to become blood or blood vessels. 2012, and 6 years after the paper was written.
Leukemia.
So, do you have a comment?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the public asks these questions because, you know, the only exposure we have to it is what we hear in the press or what we hear when some news reporter says, and in today's news, they talk about stem cell treatment for leukemia, and I think pretty much everybody's familiar with bone marrow transplants from one donor person to another person, but we don't hear much about the actual bone marrow of person A being used as a stem cell treatment in person A. Absolutely no chance of genetic rejection.
Okay, you've just gotten back to the law of pharma. And let's make it very clear. Effective January 1st, 2004, you are not allowed to put the word adult in front of the word stem cells in any positive article. I'll say it again slowly. In a positive article about stem cells, you are not allowed to put the word adult in front of the words stem cells. Lately, they've been allowed to get away with mesenchymal stem cells, which are only available from the patient himself. They are a derivative of the stem cells from the patient himself and a derivative of the stem cells from umbilical cords. So they get away with that, but never, never, never put the word adult. So you read an article yesterday, which is a very standard article. And the reason that you're not allowed to see the word adult is because, as I said before, 80% of the readers are so gullible and so brainwashed, they have no chance to understand the truth, which is when you have the word stem cells by themselves, 80% of the people will say, see, embryonic stem cells do work, because that's all they ever hear about.
Right, and that's all they ever hear about.
And you just were one of those readers saying, well, you know, at least you were knowledgeable enough to know that something's missing. But most people aren't. You write an article about stem cells, it must be about embryonics, especially if it's positive. So that's the story.
They have all the ethical questions that George Bush was talking about. I'm not going to approve, you know, fetal stem cells because we're not going to allow fetal farming and blah, blah, blah. And so we understood all of that. We understood the ethics behind that. Now, a couple of my listeners are writing me asking me, what's the website, Don? How do they find out more about the stem cell treatments that are being done?
Okay. First, let's get a couple things straight. Once the politicians got us out of the heart business, we are not now treating or research. What we've done, we started a new company called the Repair Stem Cell Institute. We started that company in 2009. And We started with what we considered the seven top stem cell doctors in the world. And every year since then, we've added two more doctors who have passed our very stringent admission policy, and we're up to 15. Now, what that means to the listener, what that means to the person with the disease that wants true information is we guide patients to the best doctors. And the first thing that everybody has to learn, which we try like heck to teach them, is there's no such thing as a standard treatment. Where is the best stem cell treatment? Well, the best stem cell treatment varies by patient. Every patient's different. And this stem cell patient might have to go to South America for the best. That one might have to go to Asia. That one might have to go to the Middle East. And we try to get them something in Latin America or the Caribbean, since it's easy to get to, but not always. And we have to guide people to the best treatment. That's what we do. We don't treat. We tell you who the best doctors are, what it's going to cost you, and we charge exactly, we don't charge anything. We charge zero. And at the end of the day, every one of the 15 doctors gives us 10% of the income in order to support our seven people who are working to service all the people writing in for information. And it wasn't started out to be a nonprofit organization, but sure has turned out to be that way.
not intentional.
Our genius accountant says three more years, 13, 14, and 15, and if we continue to go the way we're going, we'll hit the break-even mark around the end of 2015. So that's how the thing works. But the important thing for everybody to realize is we guide you to the best doctors, and we show you why they are the best doctors, and we usually give you a choice of two or three to choose from. So that's how. The name of the website again, www.repairstemcells.org. That's an S in the last letter, cells. RepairStemCells.org, O-R-G. The site is being reconstructed, but it's staying alive while we're going through the reconstruction. And at the top, in the menu at the top, it says treatment. And right under the word treatment, there's four things that we give a list of the diseases that are now being treated first. Second thing we do is we give them an application to send in for information. The third thing we do is we give them the laws that the rules that they have to use to they have to pass to get into our system. And the fourth thing is called success stories. One of the things that's being updated, we have done a lousy job of collecting every desk success story, and we're going to puff up that thing so people could understand. RepairStemCells.org is the answer to the direct question.
Well, that's what we wanted to know. I can tell you that my suspicion is that the average person's insurance policy is not going to cover this treatment. Am I right?
They're part of the system. You don't save the profit, the system's profits, by competing with it. So, of course, the insurance companies are not. The insurance companies, this is unheard of when you and I were young, Doc, but most people don't know that the health insurance insurance is so crooked. If the mafia took over the health insurance business a quarter of a century ago, it would not be as crooked as it is today.
Yeah, they could probably clean it up.
I mean, imagine a system which finds ways to, as soon as a big claim comes in, which finds ways to deny it. I mean, they go out of their way and change the rules. And they're allowed to do that because the FDA and the whole government is behind them. So they now make I know you're not going to believe this. They now make gross profit of 25%.
Oh, gross, my gosh.
I mean, can you believe this? I mean, it's, you know, you can catch this on the internet. You won't catch it in the Washington Post, of course, but you can catch it on the internet. So even if it's a paltry 20%, back in the day, and I used to work for some pretty big insurance companies, and I'm really going back in time, where a good year was after expenses, the company I was working for made 3%. That was a good year. And but as happens in all businesses, this huge company, which was at the time 1¾ century old, it was acquired by another company, that was looking into the future, this is going to be really profitable, and they grabbed this company. But it happens all over the business that the consolidation is always a feature of capitalism. So fewer insurance companies, all of them making bigger and bigger profits. So the answer to your question is yes, the insurance companies are part of the corrupt system.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, I tell people, you know, I raised four kids and did them all, paid for everything out of my pocket. And I think a few years of my career I had insurance. But most of the time, if it wasn't company supplied, we didn't have insurance. And I always felt, well, I realized that we could afford our own health care. We couldn't afford our own health insurance. We're about over $100,000 ahead of the game after all these years because we're among the 85% of Americans that are healthy. 15% of Americans are chronically ill, some kind of illness that recurs over and over and over again, and they need, or at least are, fall into the trap of continuous treatment, either by choice or by lifestyle or by genetics. They're in continuous treatment. Those 15% consume all the money that's made in the insurance business. Of course, they make lots and lots of profits on top of that because the healthy people don't go to the doctor. They pay their health insurance through their employer or whatever, but they don't go to the doctor. They don't cost the system money, in other words. So now we're in a situation where they're trying to force, you know, all 150 million adults in the United States into an insurance system. And as Don is saying, if you're looking at 25% profits, you're looking at a staggering amount of money. It's in the trillions of dollars. No, not bees anymore. I mean, we're not even talking about billions anymore. We're talking about trillions. That's enough to own everything. Well, let's take a quick break. Give your voice a rest, mine too. And we'll give out the phone number one more time. It's 888-429-5471. If you have any questions or comments about this, there are ethical questions, there are political questions, there are legal questions, and scientific questions. I know you've got them. 888-429-5471. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio and Don Margolis coming back after this.
More break. On a break.
Yes, on a break.
On a break. Dr. Doug, are you there?
Take me down to the rhythm band. Take me down to the fighting end. Wash the poison from off my skin. Show me how to be home again. Fly me up on a silver wing. Past the black where the sirens sing. Warm me up in the Nova's glow. Drop me down to the dream below. Cause I'm only crying. Love glass, hardly anything there for you to see.
In this glass of glass, hardly anything else I need to be.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians. Our guest tonight is Don Margolis. Our subject is stem cell research, the truth, the unmitigated truth. Our phone number, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. Make your questions relative to your ideas about Big Pharma, stem cell research, what we've been talking about tonight. The website is repairstemcells.org, repairstemcells, plural, .org. Check it out. Lots to read. And welcome back, Don. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thank you, all things considered, for an old man.
Well, we're holding up okay, both you and I. You know, this is really amazing technology. You're on the other side of the planet in a different time zone, and we're here in the, you know, foothills of the Appalachians, and we're having a conversation, and the world is listening in. And we have people in Australia, Germany, Missouri, California, all over Canada listening to us tonight. And this is a subject that's poignant, it's powerful, it has political overtones, economic overtones, it has conspiracy overtones to it, in the fact that we've got mega corporations that have grown over well over 100 years, and they're in an economic and a regulatory position to control a lot of us and our lives. And maybe that's what we need to talk about this hour. What do you think the possibilities are for the human being, for us to perhaps grow past or go around the politics and the economics of it and actually reach the average person with this kind of treatment, where they can overcome a specific organ disease or health disease that they might have? What are the possibilities?
Well, I guess I said it before, and I just can't see a way out. I just cannot see a way out. When you have every major newspaper, every medical journal, every television network, some local television stations are independent, but television network, especially CBS, is totally controlled by the billionaires. And you've got medical universities controlled, newspapers controlled, medical journals controlled. I don't see a way out, because the public, the 80%, will believe everything they see on television, especially from crooked infomercials like CBS 60 Minutes. They're nothing but infomercials, but the public believes they're news. And even though they were exposed on the tobacco charade in a movie with three big stars, Denzel Washington was one of them, Russell Crowe and Al Pacino did this great movie called The Insider, and it exposed CBS 60 Minutes exactly for what it is: a money-making organization where helping their listeners or viewers meant nothing to them. All it meant to them was to continue the lie. Well, it's not just CBS 60 Minutes. It's every newspaper. It's either follow the rules or don't play the game. So I don't see a way out when everything, every piece of information that gets to the patients is intentionally a lie or simply a lie of omission, just like omitting the word adult in front of the word stem cells in all the articles. So I'm sorry. I mean, people have come to me with ideas. They say, what do you think of this? And I said, I just don't think it'll work. But I'll provide information to anybody that wants it. I'm rooting for you, but I don't see it working.
Well, I completely understand the cynicism because I get it myself. After a while, you just realize what the reality of the situation is. However, we do have alternative media. And right now you have your own program every Friday at 5 p.m. called The Truth About Stem Cells on the largest webcast radio network on the planet, BBS Radio. And we're here with you. Now, we do have a caller on the line, so let's go ahead and take the call. I'm sure there are some amazing questions coming. Caller, you're live on the program.
My question to the doctor is, I'm wondering if they have stem cell therapy that can help diseases like diabetes and also, you know, people who are suffering with lung diseases and problems, if the stem cell therapies they have that can help that. And then I heard something about rejuvenation cells, rejuvenating cells just with stem cells, just, you know, the whole body. Is that really a possibility where you can actually rejuvenate the cells?
The answer is very good, actually, specifically for what you've mentioned. There are 100 diseases that are being treated now. If you have a specific disease, you just go to repairstemcells.org. Under the word treatment, is the first thing is diseases treated, and we list, as far as we can find, all the diseases that are being treated. There's roughly 100 of them. But diabetes, for sure, the doctor who created the first diabetes stem cell clinical trial is one of our top 15 doctors, and he did that way back in 06. It doesn't sound like 7 years is that far way back, but in stem cell science, 06 is way back. You ask about lung disease. That didn't really start until 09, Robin, and that's a very good point. New diseases coming out all the time. COPD is one of the diseases that stem cells are very good for. But if you're talking about different kind of complicated lung diseases, then it, the success rate won't be as high, but it's at least 50-50. But COPD is 70%. That was started 2009. 2011, we started treating kidney disease. And that's a toughie. It's a real toughie, but it works. You have to be very careful which patient you detect. So the answer, Robin, to that part is yes. Just look at the diseases treated under the word treatment on the website, and you'll know which ones are treated. But on your second question, that is, there are too many places that are talking about stem cells, and there's too many places, too many products out on the market that have stem cells somewhere on the bottle or the can, and we don't like that because we see things that stem cells really aren't in them. And in the products, and that bothers us. But there are some decent places which is called anti-aging, and we do have one of our 15 doctors is an anti-aging specialist, so we're okay with that, provided the doctor really uses stem cells. Some of them say they do and don't, but if they really use stem cells, fine. Robin, Suzanne Summers had part of a breast removed. Not the whole breast, but part of a breast removed. And it looked terrible, as you might well imagine. Well, they actually filled the hole with stem cells, created, in effect, a new breast, but with mostly the old breast, and this big hole was filled with stem cells. And the stem cells just loved it there, and they multiplied. And now you got an entire live, not false, breast. I hope that answers your question, Robin.
Oh, my gosh. Well, then I have one more. Now, I've heard lately that a lot of movie stars, like a lot of these older ones, are going back to stem cell treatment to reverse age. Like they're, you know, instead of the facelift, they're doing stem cell. Is that true?
They're getting facelifts, not necessarily with stem cells, and when they do, they hide the fact. So it's not easy to say, but I would say that right now, roughly 10, maybe 15% of the facelifts are using stem cells. The vast majority are not. So, but the answer is, if you can put stem cells into the protocol, then you're going to have something alive and kicking and making, filling out the holes and the gaps, and that if the doctor is first class and they know how to use the stem cells, I'm all for it. But it ain't cheap and it ain't easy.
Well, it's got to be a lot better than Botox.
Well, okay. Yes, but the lady asked the question. You got to tell her the truth. The truth is that most doctors don't use it, and those that do, we don't know how many really know what they're doing, but you know, there's got to be a couple out there, and we haven't made that one of our diseases so that we don't know who the really good doctors are. We wish we could help, and there are some of our science board says we should get somebody in there that knows about this, and we probably will next year.
And I have one last question, and I'm going to get off the line and let you answer, Doctor. Do you have anybody in your family or family members that have undergone some type of stem cell treatment, and what was your, then how did you feel about it afterwards, if that's so? Thank you.
You're welcome. The answer is no. Nobody in my family needed stem cell treatment. I got what was it was advertised as anti-aging, but it wasn't. It was the things that they advertised were increased memory and increased balance and healthier looking. And I took it as a test. And the only thing that happened, I was 75 when I did it, and the only thing that happened that was really worth mentioning was that my hair color returned to its original youthful color. Silver right at the temples, but the bulk of the hair returned to my dark brown color. And it's still there, and that was 3 years ago. So that's the only experience that's in my family that I know about. However, we have 100 patients that have gone through it, different treatments, and they're all willing to talk. All of our 100 patients that we've signed up are willing to talk to anybody based on disease, which disease they want to talk about. Thank you, Robin.
Yes, thank you. Now, what are the global governing authorities over this? I know in the United States we have, you know, the FDA, and we have a big pharma who supplies the money for the FDA. They supply the personnel that make up the regulatory officials and the actual decision makers inside the agency itself, as well as the interface between most of the doctors and the big clinics and the big drug companies are all supplied by these highly paid propagandists. But what is it like globally? I mean, in Europe, is it the same kind of bureaucracy as we have here, South America, Asia, India, the Middle East, or is there some global rebellion over this, especially among the more well-to-do?
The answer is no rebellion. Of course, the United States is the worst, and that is because the pharma owns the FDA and owns, I should be careful how I say that. I want to say the National Institutes of Health, which is made up of over 100 prestigious doctors. And when the FDA needs a medical cover for a decision they're making. They go right to the National Institutes of Health, and they come up with a their medically considered answer. It's a bother me that I say, geez, every time they come up with the medically based answer, the National Institutes of Health approved that which pharma wanted, whatever the deal was. Can we use this drug? Of course you can. Should we ban this alternative treatment? Of course we will. The drugs are better. Well, I always wondered about these, and these are all prestigious doctors that are admitted into the National Institutes of Health. And one day, just a few years ago, a local Chicago station exposed them that the majority, and I'm not talking about 51%, I'm talking over 75%, are major shareholders in pharma companies.
Really?
So these are the people that decide what's good for you. And they don't give a damn what's good for you. They give a damn what's good for, that makes them richer by making pharma richer. Same with the FDA. They're paid by pharma. They're operated by pharma. As I like to say, pharma is not a single company, but it is an entity. And they have one major subsidiary. And that major subsidiary is the United States government. And anybody wants to discuss that further, I'm ready for it.
Well, I would love to. I know, I was asthmatic from the time I was 5 to the time I was 52. And so I had an inhaler with me, all my life. And then I just laid it down when I was 52. I was done with asthma. It was finished. But now they've changed the inhalers. Instead of having chlorofluorocarbons as the propellant, they use propane or butane. And this is very irritating to the asthma patients, and they don't get near the relief or the time relief. Like sometimes you can take albuterol and you can get, relief for up to an hour or two from restricted passageways. But now the inhaler is much more expensive, and it's not nearly as good at treating the symptoms of the tight airways. My sister died when she was 12 of cystic fibrosis, and that was actually a pretty long life for a patient born with cystic fibrosis. Now they're treating them with lung transplants, and you just recently saw a very public argument between Health and Human Services denying a lung transplant to a 10-year-old girl, or maybe she was 9 because she was under the age of 12, because she was not eligible for adult lungs. I met the first patient who had been treated with lung transplants. I believe I was 48 when I met her, and she was about my age. So I'd never heard of a double lung transplant, but she said she went into the hospital tugging an oxygen bottle, and when she walked out, she was cured. But that's because she had someone else's lungs in her chest. Now you're saying that stem cell treatments can be used to treat COPD, which is what we used to call asthma, and patients can begin breathing normally again. Is that given using a mist or a treatment in a hospital, or is it?
In most cases, no. In most cases, it's strictly an intravenous implant of the patient's own stem cells, and in most cases, the cure. So-called cure works, so we don't call it a cure because the patient doesn't get 100% better, but it works 70% of the time with COPD. And the reason is this is the only type of implant of intravenous treatment that we approve of for our patients. There's a lot of places out there that treat hearts intravenously and treat diabetes intravenously, and sometimes it works, but we don't approve it for our patients. But we do approve lungs, and there's a very simple reason for that, and I'm sure you'll understand that there is no more powerful organ in the body than the lung. The lung grabs whatever stem cells it wants and releases the rest to go around the body for the little guys. But the lung always gets whatever it wants because it's just that powerful at grabbing stem cells. So stem cell intravenous treatments for lungs, we like. And they work in COPD. Isn't bronchitis also considered COPD?
Yeah, inflammation of the passageways. Bronchitis usually ends up in a really wicked, you know, histamine reaction. Lots of phlegm and coughing, and you can end up scarring the esophagus. All kinds of problems occur with pneumonia because, as you know, pneumococci are anaerobic, and so when the lungs fill with phlegm, the pneumococci bloom in the bottom of the lung, and the toxins made by pneumococci can kill you. So there are all kinds of side effects from that. But if the passageways never become inflamed, then you don't have that histamine or that phlegm reaction, and that stops the cycle.
I have some experience with that, which we won't discuss now.
Well, I mean, I come from a family of doctors, and I read incessantly, so I just know how that works. But I've seen cystic fibrosis patients go through what's called therapy, which is literally hammering on the chest cavity to shake loose the thick phlegm that builds up in the lungs. And then, of course, the patient has to expel that, which is really violent, hard coughing. And it just wears the patient out, and eventually it kills them. But That's the way we've been treating it for 50 years.
They don't have an aspirator that can do that, or is it just too tough?
It's this stuff is not like normal phlegm. It's very thick. It's not like normal mucus that flows with cilia movement. It really has to be expelled using really hard coughing, and it comes out. It's kind of gummy. It's not flowing at all.
Wow. Okay. Do we want to get into the beginnings of the embryonic hoax now, or should we save it for some other time?
No. This is a good time because, you know, pharmacology is all about marketing and duping the public into thinking that whatever's in that bottle, they have to have, and you must go buy it every single month or you're going to die. I can't tell you how many times I've had doctors tell me that. And, you know, they say, you know, you can't go on living like you're living. I say, why? Because this is normal where I come from. And they say, no. We have patients that have, you know, blood coming out of their eyes with situations like you have. And I say, well, you know, look at my eyes. Go ahead. Take your magnifier and look at my pupils. Look at the back of my cornea and tell me, you see any broken blood vessels? No. Do you see any symptoms at all that are typical with this kind of condition? No. So is it safe to say that you really don't know what you're talking about? Look, if you don't take these drugs, you're going to die. Okay, well, I'm close to 60, and I can still beat most of my 40-year-old friends in tennis. So I'm probably not going to die. And I think that this hoax, this marketing hoax that they have dragged people into, where they are, as you said, medical deities. They're prima donnas. They're gods in the community in which they live, and on national TV. My goodness, every news show has some team of medical experts that will tell you about everything from, you know, obesity to cholesterol levels to what you should eat and not eat and how you should exercise and all that. We believe it. So what they have done, apparently, is they have sold us on the idea that all stem cells are embryonic. What's the hoax here? How they want to dumb us down? What are they trying to tell us here?
What they're trying to tell us is that they're scared of if adult stem cells are let loose, their profits will plummet, and people will understand that they're being hoaxed. Now, how does it work? Let's go back in history real fast. Back to 1998, Dr. Thompson isolated embryonic cells, and Dr. Doris Taylor proved that adult stem cells can mend the heart, negating 100 years of false dogma that heart tissue cannot be renewed. But let's keep going. Dr. Taylor and Dr. Thompson separately both said it, we think 15 to 20 years before this will be done on humans. So now we looked at the stem cells in the jar we talked about. But In the year 2000, only 2 years later, I know of two patients who were dying, very close to dying, who were treated with stem cells, and both lasted a few years. But they were kept secret, and until they died, the information was not allowed to be released. But in 2001, Hong Kong, Brazil, and Germany each had a clinical trial started. And in 2003, the results were released, and they all were virtually identical. Roughly 80% of the patients got better. Now, that's a little bit of a fantasy. The real number should be 70%, but if you're in the business, you know that the sickest people cannot be treated in a clinical trial. They can't risk that person dying and screwing up the whole process.
Yeah, exactly right. But this is really stunning that you had multiple clinics with multiple patient populations, and they roughly got the same statistics. That's phenomenal.
Oh, yeah, 75 to low, high 70s, low 80s. And it goes on to this day. America's greatest stem cell clinical trial doctor is Joshua Hare at the University of Miami. You can get into one. You go to Joshua Hare and tell him Don Margolis sent you, and you know he'll listen to you. And but it's tough to get in, as you can imagine. Everybody wants to get in and get stem cells for free, but if you're under a Joshua Hare treatment at University of Miami, then you got the best you can get right now. Now, there's a Dr. Dibb in Arizona. He's very good, and Baxter, a big a medical company, is sponsoring has been sponsored.
Oh, don't tell me we lost Don. By the way, I used to work for Baxter, not as a doctor per se.
It's going to hurt their friends. So, if you want a clinical trial, ladies and gentlemen, you go to clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V. The first thing you come to is a search engine. Learn how to operate that search engine, and you'll find out all you want to find out. We can go over that some other time, but that's how you get into a trial. Meanwhile, the Brazil trial, I mentioned three countries, the Brazil trial was spectacular. What they did was they took this bone marrow stem cells, autologous stem cells, but their patients were volunteers from the transplant list. So they were really sick. And so, like all other clinical trials, they did not reject dying people. They took sick people. And they got 21 of them. And they did a random, I'm told, search as a selection, 14 stem cells, 7 no stem cells. About half the patients, half the 14 got better. Not cured, of course, but better. And about 4 of them dropped out. They didn't want their transplant anymore. And another 4 loved their life. And what happened was the 7 who got the placebo got nothing. And that was the result, and it was spectacular. And that paper was picked up by the American Heart Association. That's the big cardiological association in the United States of America. And they published that paper.
Really?
And that scared the hell out of pharmacy.
Oh, my goodness. So, you know, just to let people know, normally what happens is you do, let's say, a clinical trial. You'll have, let's say, 50 patients. So you give 25 of them a placebo, which is just a sugar pill, and 25 of them the actual drug. Now, invariably, some of those that get the placebo will have a very similar reaction to people that got the drug. In other words, their symptom, their headache goes away, their blood pressure comes down, they have less pain or whatever. And they don't really know why that is. And the people really believe that they're getting some kind of treatment from that drug, and so they report having some improvement. But to get zero improvement from the placebo group is absolutely stunning, stunning results. Go ahead, continue.
Five of them opted. They had a perfect right to get the stem cell 6 months after their placebo. And that happens with most clinical trials. And they got, five of them got their stem cells, a grand total of 19. Two just dropped out and went back onto the transplant list. Mm-hmm. Now I want to give you a couple of figures. I have a lot of friends who are in the transplant business, and especially since I've been in the heart business, and you know, I got friendly with them. And I asked them, what percent of your patients waiting for a transplant die per year? And the number varied from 35 to 42%. So I decided to take the most conservative number and say 35% die every year. So the question is, you have 19 people and you 35% die a year. At the end of 5 years, there are 2.2 people alive. Okay, it's an easy calculation. You just die. You just kill 35% every year, and you wind up with 2.2 people. At the end of 5 years, I called up my friends in Brazil and said, hey, guys, this is long after the paper had been published, and it's about a year later. And I said, as of December of 07, and I was calling them like in January or February, I said, how many of those 19 people are alive? And they didn't know, because it wasn't part of their clinical trial how long they lasted. So they told me to call back in a week, and they gathered the information, and I called back in a week, and they were astounded. And I was a little bit astounded. Of the 19, 12 had lasted the 5 years. So what that means is, I've been throwing this figure around, not just because of what they did, but in the next 2 years I discover some other things too, that cardiac patients die at five times the rate of stem cell cardiac patients. Do I have to say that again? Five times the rate of death from cardiac patients versus stem cell cardiac patients.
And now keep in mind that this was a clinical trial. This was not something that was well refined, well researched, where they had a lot of the variables worked out. This was brand new stuff. And I would venture to say, if those patients could be surveyed on the actual quality of life that they had during those 5 years compared to a transplant patient, I would venture to say that their quality of life was far better.
Obviously. There was another one by Dr. Roberto Vigna in Argentina that he announced in 08. I happened to be in Cincinnati when he presented it, and the statistics were virtually the same. However, the best of all happened in Europe in 2010 when a doctor by the name of Bodo Strouwer produced a clinical trial result for 391 patients. 191 got stem cells, and 200 got standard cardiology. And at the end of 5 years, Strouwer published the following two figures, among many others, but this one hit me right in the nose. The annual mortality for the stem cell patients who got cardiology treatments plus stem cell treatments was 7.6 deaths per 1,000 per year.
Unbelievable.
Now, let's move over to the non-stem cell, to the standard cardiology deaths. Are you ready? Cardiology only, 36 deaths per 1,000 per year. Five times as many.
Unbelievable.
So
and those of the ones that got the stem cell treatment, they had one thing missing. They had a 27-inch scar right down the middle of their chest missing.
No. I can't say because Strauer started his in 03 and Venia started his in 03. And in 03, I don't know how they were implanting them at that time. If it was today, there would be nobody does with surgery starting 09. So I can't answer that. It could be right. But in any event, all three doctors, and they hardly knew each other, if at all, all three of them got the same results, the same long-term results, five times the death rates.
Well, I can tell you now that the medical instrument, medical device industry is very well refined and very innovative. I used to work for Baxter, not as a doctor, but as a Six Sigma black belt doing refurbishing of the infusion controllers, the single cell and the triple deck infusion controllers, because we had an FDA recall to do, I don't know, like 40,000 of them to replace the pumps and programs and things like that. But I also did a contract for Arrow. Arrow is also Teleflex, which is a medical device company that supplies a myriad of catheters. And some of these catheters are very innovative. They have little radio transmitters in the very end of the catheter. So when they slide the arterial catheter in, you know, under the arm or up the thigh, they can track the tip of the catheter to the exact spot in the heart where they want the tip of that catheter to be. It's much less invasive to the patient. Once that tip is where it needs to be, then they can deliver the drug or the treatment exactly to the point in the heart where they want it to go. So the medical device company has the technology, the capability to put these stem cells exactly where they need to go in that organ without having to cut the person open. They just make a tiny incision and go in through the artery.
Well, I have some things I'd rather not talk about the industry you just did at this time, about the actual FDA system for medical devices. It's awfully bad.
Oh,
I don't want to get into it right now.
I know it's corrupt.
So pharma said, and here was the origin of the stem cell hoax. They had, as you know, they had control of almost all media and control of the government, especially the FDA. So what they did, they said, now how do we convince people that we're going to keep adult stem cells from ruining our profits, but we got to do it for a reason? And that reason is they don't work, and that embryonic stem cells are the future. Now, of course, we know that embryonic stem cells will never work. So therefore, we can push embryonic stem cells all we want, knowing they will never hurt our profits. But adult stem cells could kill us. And therefore, we have to pass the word that instead of saving lives, we're going to kill people by convincing them that stem cells don't work, adult stem cells don't work. And here's the many ways we're going to do it. Number one, biggest reason of all, is to get the church, when I say the church, I mean the Christian church, whether Catholic or Protestant, born-again Christians or not, against abortions, which is pretty easy to do, and then get the liberals, who are all in favor of women's rights, in favor of embryonic stem cells, and make it a political religious argument. And never, 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 never let stem cell science end.
Uh-oh, what happened?
Two or four.
Oh, there he is. Say that one, that way, that one been, part after never, ever, ever again because you cut out. I really want to get that out in the air.
Well, those are the arguments make the argument strictly religion versus liberals. And the liberals will always believe that stem cells, embryonic stem cells, are the future, and they do. And the conservatives will always be against embryonic stem cells, and the argument will be religious and political, and never, never, never mention the science. So they made up the science rules, and the science rules were always say that embryonic stem cells can do more things than adult stem cells, always say adult stem cells are unproven, and always say that never say that embryonic stem cells cause cancer, which they do, but hint that adult stem cells cause cancer, which they never do. And them's the rules. And then they did two things. They started this absolutely corrupt, crooked operation in California called CIRM, we mentioned that before, which steals money from the state and gives it out to and makes millions for the crooks that started it and pays the con man from Australia twice what the government pays, pays the governor, and the newspapers are all on side of the side of the embryonics because they know they had better be. So that's one organization that was helped by pharma and by the FDA, of course. And the other is they created a totally murderous, corrupt organization, worldwide organization called the International Center for Stem Cell Research, or something like that, and ISSC. It composed of virtually every medical researcher that's involved in stem cells. And they know one thing. They will never get publishing adult stem cell articles because they just won't ever get published with, you know, the phony word peer that gets used. The peers are peers, and that all they do is they check minimally for accuracy, but if it's pro-embryonic, it's likely to get published, and if it's pro-adult stem cells, it never gets published.
Wow.
So that is the business that feeds your doctor information. What chance does the poor son of a gun have of ever getting anything true? And the answer is none. So those two organizations are the backbone of the hoax. The funny thing was, in 2004, when California was pushing all kinds of nonsense and getting suckers to, after the $6 million was stolen from the Treasury and put aside for the crooks to divide up among themselves, they needed more money. So they got people to buy these sure-to-make-profits on embryonic stem cells bonds, and suckers put money, hundreds of thousands of dollars into bonds. And all that money is long gone. It's already been dispersed among the crooks. So that was California in 2004. But Stanford didn't go along with it. Stanford saw the hoax in the bond, and they said, the data we have. So Stanford was standing neutral. Harvard was well under the pay of pharma. Harvard is corrupt as can be. They got a poor victim by the name of Superman, who was paralyzed in a horse accident. I won't tell you his name, but his initials were Christopher Reeve. Yeah. While he was still alive, the one great spinal cord doctor in the world in Portugal was treating people with adult stem cells with an amazing new treatment. And two of his treated patients came back and went before Congress to show how well they were doing and spoke before Congress. And Harvard kept Christopher Reeve. Embryonics are the future. And he died quite reasonably because had he still been alive, he would have had no chance for a treatment. Now, Somebody told me a couple years ago that statement is not true. Geron, a California company, was running a clinical trial in 2010, and I said it would never happen. And he says, the FDA has approved that it's going to happen. 6 months later, they did not start the clinical trial. Geron knew something was wrong. 2011, the pressure was coming and screaming from Parma to get one clinical trial, and coming from the California CIRM, they had not one clinical trial. And so Geron was pushed again, since they were a very, very crooked company, had stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from shareholders. They agreed to a clinical trial. And naturally, here comes all the corrupt medical universities joining this wonderful clinical trial so they can get enough patients. Now, there's a 500,000 spinal cord patients in America. 500,000. And here's 18 places around the country all dying to get into this clinical trial, all approved, and waiting for the patients. And publicity came out, and they had six patients, and once I think I saw eight, and I never saw larger numbers than that. And 6 months goes by, and this clinical trial is going on, and they have a big interview from the first patient, like a month after he was treated, and of course he had no results, but he was all positive and cheering, rah, 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 for embryonic stem cells. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, came an announcement from Geron, the clinical trial is being called off, we don't have the money. Now, I know what happened, and you know what happened. They had all the money they wanted from the FDA, all they wanted. They had all the money they wanted from the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, all they wanted. And they said, this embryonic stem cells cost too much money. Well, they're true. That's true. Embryonic stem cells cost roughly 10 times what adult stem cells cost to make. But that has nothing to do with the decision. The decision was made for one reason and one reason only. And you know what that reason is, Doc.
Absolutely.
That a patient had... something happened to a patient. 3 months later, another executive of Geron came out with another reason. Said it really wasn't the money, because everybody knew they had the money or could get it. And he said it... Another 3 months went by, and another executive who had left the company and gone to join another company came up with another reason for stopping the clinical trial. But none of the reasons were the truth, that some patient had some sort of hugely negative reaction, and that was the only reason they ran. And so the only stem cell treatment where they actually put stem cells into the patients was Geron's. Now, there's one going on now from a company called ACT, and they're doing the same. They're getting all the money they want from California. They get all the money from the FDA, and they get money from investors. And they're not treating with pure stem cells. They're treating with a compound that they believe will keep the patients from getting cancer and a immune system reaction. And that part seems to be okay. No immune reaction and no cancer from the patients. They're only treating macular degeneration in the eye, and the stem cells apparently never leave the eye. So they can't cause too much damage. But it's for a disease which was something like 1% of 1% of the population has. And it's Stargardt's, it's an eye disease called Stargardt's. So that's the rah-rah for embryonic stem cells. Exactly 4 years after Bush has left office, 4.5 years after Bush has left office, not one cure has come out of the pipeline. And that's the embryonic hoax. And you are still being hoaxed, because the Democrat Party is still pushing embryonics, because they're paid to by pharma. Pharma pays them a lot of money to continue this embryonic hoax, and continue to make the fight a political, religious argument and never, never, never get into the science that adult stem cells work and embryonic stem cells are a fraud.
Well, we talk about the effect of money on politics, and it's not just, you know, money from the average contributor or even small corporations, you know, putting in $100 or $200 here or there, or even $1,000 or $10,000. What we are seeing is the wholesale fascist transition of an agency government that is not elected, but it is controlled by corporate money. These large global corporations have become the rulers over our society. And Congress can't do anything about it. The Senate is emasculated. And the secretaries, which work absolutely for the president and only the president, do his bidding, interpret the regulations inside of these agencies within certain bounds. But the real horsepower in those agencies come directly from, and have for 50 years, come directly from these major corporations, whether it's steel or oil or pharmacology or genetically modified organisms. These officials come from the executive ranks of these major corporations. And it's a revolving door between the agencies and these corporations. In and out they go. Now, sometimes conservatives, and I'm not going to say whether they're Democrat or Republican, conservatives tend to put their own spin on it, and liberals tend to put their own spin on it, but they never stop it. It just keeps going and growing. And it's so large and so powerful now that I don't think elected government will ever make a change in it. I don't think the public is smart enough to make a change in it. It is going to have to come through constitutional amendment or some other major revolution in the way our government works. Sorry, that's just my that's my scientific analysis of the situation. It is beyond repair.
I can't agree more, but I saw an example. I'm not much of a liberal, and I'm not much of a conservative. I'm a libertarian, but I saw something happen around the last presidential election time before that. The one true liberal in Congress, when I say true liberal, not somebody who calls himself a liberal, but somebody who believes fervently in the liberal rules and regulations and what liberalism is Denis Kucinich.
Yeah,
and
I know
And somehow, somebody stripped him of his testicles and he wound up powerless. And I really felt sorry for him. I know it was big business, and I know all they had to do was say, we'll put up $100 million for your opponent in the next election. Now, I always respected Denis Kucinich because he was a true liberal and he believed in what he spoke about, and I respected that just like I respected Barry Goldwater back in the day. As he really did believe in what he was talking about. Well, that just saddened me to the point where I just said that you know, I've known we were in trouble before that, but this was it. When they can do that to a great guy like Denis Kucinich,
you know, you're absolutely right, because you know, I watched Denis for years, and he's kind of a bulldog in Congress. But then when I met him, and I was talking to him, and I asked him, you know, what are you going to do about this banking situation that we have? Small business has been cut out of the capital game. We have no access to capital, and these banks are not meeting the credit needs of their communities. And Don, I got to tell you, he looked at the floor, he shuffled his feet back and forth, and he said, well, you know, those banks, they're always two steps ahead of us, and we just can't seem to outsmart them. They just have a way of hiding the money and not getting it to where it needs to go in the community. He was not the bulldog at all. He was a whooped pup at that point.
Well, I feel sorry for him, and I know that he actually, I am assuming he had no defense against what they did to him.
No question about it. Don, it has been an amazing 2 hours. We should have made it three. We will do it again. I'd be happy to come on your program and talk again with you if you want. But we are
okay,
out of time.
How about the fourth week, the last Friday of this month?
Last Friday this month, I'd be happy to. No problem.
Okie doke, you're on. Thank you for being a wonderful host, and I haven't enjoyed myself on the radio this much in years. That goes back to when I was doing sports announcing in for Metro Media in Philadelphia. It goes way back.
Wow. Thank you so much, and welcome to BBS Radio Network.
I appreciate it. Bye for now.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, my Earth Explorer friends, that is it for us. We got to let you go. Channel 2 has to put another host on. We will see you next week, the 21st of July, right here on X Squared Radio.